Why was Moscow the site of two particularly deadly human crushes? It's where the very top of society reached out to the very low. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. A little over a century later, another royal ceremony led to a massive crush. At the coronation of Tsar Nicholas II in 1896, thousands, possibly tens of thousands, of people were crushed while rushing towards free gifts. Some literature refers to this kind of crowd motion as a craze. This kind of crush was the first that was well documented, and it's come to dominate the imagination. It conjures images of a hungry crowd carelessly crushing the weak amongst them underfoot in their headlong greedy rush. Despite this general perception, within Russia, the blame fell squarely on the monarchy. Whereas the wedding celebration crush of Louis XVI was seen as a bad omen, this coronation crush took on great significance for the revolutions that followed. The day after Tsar Nicholas II's official coronation, a large celebration was held in Kudyinka Field, outside Moscow. It was the same field where his father had celebrated his coronation just 13 years earlier, and it all went well. In preparation for the event, temporary theaters, pubs, and stands were erected to provide one and all with a wonderful time. The celebration held great political significance for the Tsar. The Russian Empire had evolved into a highly autocratic state, where all power rested in the hands of a very small aristocracy. The country was still in the process of abolishing serfdom, which was a system that held many similarities to chattel slavery like that practiced in America. Peasants who worked on private lands could be bought and sold by those landowners, moved to wherever they were sold, beaten for any reason, and they could not marry peasants who lived on other estates to keep families on a single estate. 10 million Russians lived in this condition, which was as much as 38% of the population. Although serfdom was legally abolished, and the crown had taken steps to alleviate its worst abuses, the country still had no formal civil rights, no formal representative bodies, and almost all of the land was still held by a small minority of nobles. Contrary to popular belief, however, Russian income inequality wasn't exceptional, and it was actually less extreme than inequality in America and Russia today. Although this is more of a reflection of the overall poverty of the country than anything else. Political inequality dominated the concerns of the lower classes. They wanted more control over their personal fates. The Tsar's power rested on shaky foundations, in a world where many of the myths of monarchy had been exposed. Nicholas did what autocrats have always done to alleviate the pressure for reform. He courted the affection of the lower classes. His continued survival relied on a magisterial but benevolent image, this idea of the king as protector of the people in a turbulent world. As such, he invited all people to share in the glory of his coronation. In the 13 years since his father's coronation, the population of Moscow had grown, as well as the general transport infrastructure of the country. A lot more people could get to Moscow now. The celebration was more accessible to the citizens than ever. People began pouring into Kudyinka Field from across the empire. Tens of thousands, maybe as many as 500,000, people gathered to collect gifts from the Tsar, which were a bread roll, a piece of sausage, pretzels, gingerbread, and a commemorative cup. These cups would come to be known as the Cup of Sorrows, in the memory of the crush. In such an enormous crowd, impatience began to set in, aided by rumors. What probably began as simple wondering if the line would ever start moving turned to fear that there wouldn't be enough gifts to go around, and that the gifts were being distributed unfairly. The crowd began to surge, which led to deadly pileups. So this field was very mottled with ravines and ditches, which presented hazards to a crowd unable to see very far ahead of themselves. It appears that authorities put no thought into how people would get into and away from the gift stands. Leo Tolstoy, who at this time was an old and respected writer as well as a social justice advocate, he wrote a short story about the event to draw attention to it. And here he describes the experience of falling in the ditch while approaching the gifts. Earlier, he didn't see anything in front of him except for people's backs. And now, suddenly, everything opened up ahead of him. He saw tents, those tents from which the gifts were supposedly to be given. He rejoiced, but his joy lasted only a minute, because he immediately realized that what had opened to him ahead of him opened only because they all came to a ravine, and all who were in front of him, some on legs, others kneeling, fell into it. And he is falling there too, over the people. He's falling on the people, and others from behind are falling on him. And then, for the first time, fear found him. He fell. A woman in a headscarf fell upon him. He shook her off his back, wanted to return, but others pressed from behind, and he didn't have the strength. He leaned forward, but his feet set on soft, on people. They grabbed him by the legs and screaming. He saw nothing, heard nothing, and moved forward, treading on people. Casualty estimates vary widely. Officially, 1,282 corpses were collected from the scene. Somewhere between 9,000 and 12,000 people were injured, however. No attempts were made to provide first aid, only to evacuate the crowd and dispose of the bodies. The Tsar was informed of the tragedy, but the scene was cleaned up before he arrived, and he actually saw none of the horrors. He wrote in his diary about attending the square to give condolences, quote, "Actually, there was nothing going on." He then attended a ball held by the French ambassador. It's likely that Nicholas considered the crushing to be more of a personal tragedy that he shouldn't let interfere with his duties as head of state. And he also relied on French support for power. He couldn't afford to offend the ambassador. But regardless, this decision to go to the ball stirred up mass resentment at the time. Even the Chinese ambassador, who was at the ball, commented that his emperor would not have come. This resentment set the stage for the violent revolutions that followed. The Tsar distributed aid to the families, and minor officials were sacked, including the Moscow chief of police. The response was widely considered inadequate, however, and some took to calling their new emperor Nicholas the Bloody. A decade later, a violent uprising created the first representative governing bodies in Russia. Another decade later, the monarchy was toppled at the height of World War I. In the reappraisal of Nicholas's reign by the Communist Revolution, the Kodinka tragedy was seen not just as a bad omen, but as a misuse of power by a high-handed and tone-deaf aristocracy. The lack of planning, lack of responsibility, and disregard for human life came to dominate discussions of the event, and it came to be seen as a crime perpetrated against the Russian people. The great leader's death. It's a sad irony, then, that a remarkably similar event happened at the funeral of the communist absolute ruler Stalin about 60 years later. We actually have less information about this event than the coronation of Nicholas II, despite it happening much more recently, because the communist regime was more effective than their predecessors at covering up information and covering up the mistakes of the government. By the time of his death in 1953, Stalin had held absolute power in the USSR for 3 decades. In that time, he'd built a cult of personality that stressed brotherhood with the common man, combined with an unquestioning devotion to a narrow set of ideological principles. This cult involved intense personal devotion to the state, as it was embodied by Stalin himself. In many ways, this was a development of the strategy that the Tsars had been pursuing, the cultivation of a personal devotion to a distant and benevolent ruler. The Communist Revolution defeated the short-lived Democratic Revolution long ago. The civil and political rights demanded of Nicholas II had never materialized under this new order. At the same time, Stalin was a personal savior to Soviet peoples. A very real and visceral reason for this was that he had rolled back the forces of Nazi Germany. The invasion had reached within 15 miles of Moscow, and had subjected the most populated parts of the USSR to vicious war crimes. The horrors of the occupied Soviet Union in those years of World War II only hinted at the large-scale deportment, slaughter, and abuse planned for them by the Nazi regime. Many Soviets felt a significant debt to Stalin for saving them from this fate. Upon his death, the suddenly rudderless Soviet leadership praised Stalin's achievements publicly, while a brutal and bloody power struggle ensued behind the scenes. The potential successors leapt at the chance to associate themselves with the great leader one last time. This would be the funeral to end all funerals. Soviet citizens flooded into Moscow as soon as Stalin's death became public. The next day, March 6, 1953, people flooded into Trubnaya Square to view the great leader's body. They channeled through a narrow boulevard that descended sharply until they found their path blocked by trucks and troops on horseback. Once the crowd was stopped, even temporarily, crowd turbulence set in and whirlpools of people began to form. People who were forced into window wells along the street were trampled quickly. Some people were even pressed onto the iron bars on windows, and they were slowly, excruciatingly stabbed through by the force of the crowd. Inhabitants on the lower floors of these buildings listened to the screams of the crushed, and then they heard the grinding, crunching of the bodies. Police initially interpreted the crush as disobedience and responded aggressively. According to several reports, the crush could have been alleviated by simply moving the trucks that were blocking the boulevard, and when one of the trucks was destroyed by the pressure of the people, bodies came tumbling over it. Eventually, the police began lifting women and children out of the crowd and evacuating them. A vivid account of the crush comes from Yevgeny Yevtushenko, a major poet of the Khrushchev era and critic of Stalinist repression. He wrote, quote, "New streams poured into the human torrent from behind, increasing the pressure. The crowd turned into a monstrous whirlpool. I realized that I was being carried straight towards a traffic light. The post was coming relentlessly closer. Suddenly I saw that a young girl was being pushed against the post. Her face was distorted by a despairing scream that was inaudible amongst all the other screams and groans. A movement of the crowd drove me against the girl. I could not hear, but I felt with my body the cracking of her brittle bones as they were broken on the traffic light. I closed my eyes in horror. I could not bear the sight of her insanely bulging, childish blue eyes, and I was swept past. I was saved by my height. Short people were smothered alive. We were caught between the walls of the houses on one side and a row of army trucks on the other. Get the trucks out of the way, people howled. Get them away. I can't. I've got no instructions, a very young, fair, bewildered police officer shouted back from one of the trucks, almost crying with desperation. And people were being hurtled against the trucks by the crowd, and their heads smashed. The sides of the trucks were running with blood. All at once, I felt a savage hatred for everything that had given birth to that no instructions shouted at a moment when people were dying of someone's stupidity. For the first time in my life, I thought with hatred of the man that we were burying. He could not be innocent of the disaster. It was the no instructions that had caused the chaos and bloodshed at his funeral. Now I saw once and for all that it's no good waiting for instructions if human lives are at stake. You must act. Janitors worked all night long to clean up the mess of bodies and body parts. Apparently, the street was clean by morning. To reduce the official death toll, many of the dead were issued certificates with natural causes of death. The number of dead eventually released by Khrushchev in 1962, a decade later, was 109. Estimates vary, but some reach upwards of 2 or 3,000 casualties, comparable to the Kodinka tragedy. Deaths were no doubt compounded by the slow response by authorities and the total failure to provide first aid. Streets were completely blocked all over Moscow, and surviving victims had to find their own way to the hospitals. Although images and videos of the funeral services were widely disseminated, the crush was successfully covered up for many years. To this day, little is known about it in English, and the Soviet records remain unavailable. It's likely that the same brutal authoritarianism that caused the crush will also prevent us from ever knowing its full details.